Pull up a chair. I want you to close your eyes for a second, even if you're driving, so maybe just soften your focus on the road. I'm standing on the bush plane ramp at Oshkosh. It's early, and the dew hasn't burned off the grass yet. And in front of me is a row of the most honest airplanes ever built. High wings. Fat tires taller than a fire hydrant, the ones we call tundra tires, soft as marshmallows, fabric flanks. Little two-seat tail draggers with prop clearance for days and struts you could hang a side of beef from. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Tail Dragger, and you're listening to The Hangar. And today, surrounded by these backcountry machines, I want to tell you about a man who took airplanes just like these and landed them where no wheel had any business touching down. On the side of the tallest mountain in North America, on moving ice, his name was Don Sheldon. Now, before I get rolling, today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. And I'll tell you, the fella I'm about to describe earned every coin they could have struck. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. So, let me set the scene. Talkeetna, Alaska. If you've never been, picture a little frontier town at the end of a spur road, sitting where three rivers come together, log buildings, a dirt airstrip, and rising up out of the north, filling the whole sky, a wall of white so big your brain has trouble believing it. The Alaska Range and the king of it all, Denali. 20,310 feet of rock and ice. Back then, they called it Mount McKinley. Don Sheldon showed up in that country as a young man in the 1930s. Came north like a lot of folks did, chasing work, chasing something. He learned to fly the hard way. No fancy academy, no glass panel. He flew with the old-timers, the first generation of Alaska bush pilots, men who were making it up as they went because nobody had ever done it before. And here's the thing you have to understand about flying in that part of the world. There are no roads, there's no diversion airport, there's no controller watching you on radar telling you about traffic. Back when Aviguiz was cheap and airspace was free, well, up there the airspace is still free, and it'll kill you six different ways before breakfast. The weather comes down off the glaciers with no warning, the valleys are box canyons that dead end into granite, and if you go down, nobody's coming. You're the rescue. Sheldon flew Super Cubs, Cessna 180s, little airplanes not so different from the ones parked right here in front of me on this Oshkosh grass. And he did something with them that changed what everybody thought was possible. Now here's where it gets interesting. In the early days, climbers who wanted to attempt Denali faced a brutal problem. Just getting to the base of the mountain meant weeks of slogging through swamp and forest and river crossings before they even strapped on a crampon. The approach was harder than the climb. Men wore themselves out before the real work began. Sheldon looked up at those glaciers, those great rivers of ice pouring down between the peaks, and he had a notion. What if he just flew the climbers up? What if he set an airplane down on the glacier itself, at 7,000 feet, at 10,000 feet, and dropped them at the doorstep of the mountain? Everybody told him it couldn't be done, and they had good reasons. A glacier is not a runway, it's a frozen river, and it's moving, slow but constant. The surface is a nightmare. Crevasses, cracks in the ice hundreds of feet deep, some of them hidden under a skin of snow that'll swallow an airplane whole. The slope isn't flat. You're landing uphill into the mountain, and the light, oh, the light. On an overcast day, the snow in the sky turn the same shade of milk white, and the horizon just disappears. Pilots call it a whiteout. You cannot tell up from down, you cannot tell where the surface is. Men have flown perfectly good airplanes straight into the snow because their eyes told them they were still 50 feet up. Sheldon taught himself to land on that. He fitted his airplanes with skis. He learned to read the texture of the snow, to throw his own shadow across it, to drag the strip low and slow first, looking. Always looking before he committed. He learned to land uphill so the mountain itself would stop him, and take off downhill so gravity would give him the speed he needed before he ran out of glacier. He'd touch down, keep the power up, because if you let that airplane settle and stop in the wrong spot, the soft snow would grab those skis and you'd never move again. Think about the nerve that took. The first time, there's no instructor, there's no one who's done it before. There's just you and the airplane and a slope of ice with a mountain at the top of it. And the absolute certainty that if you get it wrong, that's the end of the story. He got it right, again and again and again, for 30 years. Let me tell you about one day in particular, because it tells you everything about the man. 1960, a military climbing expedition on Denali. Some of the men had fallen badly hurt, stranded way up high on the mountain, above the altitude where any helicopter of the day could safely operate. The air's too thin up there, rotors don't bite, and the weather had closed in. Sheldon flew. Of course he flew. He took that little airplane up into the thin cold air where the engine's making a fraction of its sea level power, where the wings barely want to hold you. And he threaded it through the peaks to a spot near 14,000 feet. He couldn't land in the usual sense, so he'd come in, drag a ski, slow to a crawl, and in some of these rescues the technique was to barely touch and go, hauling men aboard in the seconds the airplane was in contact with the snow, then pouring the coals to it and diving off the edge of the glacier to build flying speed. He made trip after trip. One airplane, two seats, a mountain full of injured men. He just kept going back up, kept threading the needle. Kept setting those skis down in a place that would have terrified any sane person, because there were men up there who would die if he didn't. And the weather up there doesn't ask your permission. Clouds would come boiling up a valley and Sheldon would be caught between a rock wall on one side and a cloud bank on the other with the ground rising up to meet him. He flew by feel, by an intimacy with that mountain that came from 10,000 hours of staring at it in every mood it had. Can you smell that cockpit? Cold aluminum? Gasoline, wet wool from the climber's gear. The bite of the outside air coming through the vents at 20 below, the engine hammering away out front, that Continental or Lycoming just singing, the only warm living thing for miles, and out the windscreen, nothing but white and rock and a slope that wants to kill you. That was Don Sheldon's office, every single day. He didn't just fly rescues, he flew hunters and prospectors and surveyors and mail. He flew the mountain climbers in and, God willing, back out. He plucked people off sandbars and mountaintops and the edges of rivers. It's said he saved dozens of lives over his career, maybe more, in places nobody else could reach or would even try. He became, quite simply, the man you called when there was no other hope. And he did it with airplanes that, honestly, you could walk over and touch right here at Oshkosh. That's what gets me. Standing here on the bush plane ramp looking at these Super Cubs on their big soft tires, these little Cessnas with the extended gear and the drooped wingtips, this is Sheldon's toolkit. Nothing exotic, no jet engine, no autopilot flying the approach for you, just a good honest airplane, a stick and rudder, and a pilot who knew exactly what his machine could do and what it couldn't. That's the thread that runs from Talkeetna straight through these grounds. Every year at AirVenture there's a STEL demonstration, short takeoff and landing, and you'll see pilots put a tail dragger down and stop it in what looks like its own length, then leap back into the air in a couple hundred feet. The crowd goes wild, and they should. But when I watch that, I don't just see a contest, I see the direct descendant of what Sheldon did for real on a live glacier, with lives in the balance. The backcountry crowd, the folks who fly into the gravel bars and the ridgetop strips, they are keeping his craft alive, same skills, same respect for the airplane, same understanding. That in that kind of flying, the margin between showing off and dying is very, very thin, and the difference is judgment. Sheldon had judgment in spades. That's the part that doesn't make the movies. Everybody wants to talk about the daring, the bravery, and sure, it was there. But the reason he lived to fly for 30 years in the deadliest flying country on Earth wasn't that he was fearless, it's that he was disciplined. He looked before he landed. He knew when to turn around. He'd fly all the way to a stranded party, take one look at the weather draping over the pass, and go home and come back the next day, because a dead rescue pilot rescues nobody. There's a lesson in that for every one of us. Whether you're flying a glacier or a grass strip or across country to right here at Whitman Field. Now, Denali doesn't forget the people who understood it. On the south side of that mountain, high up in a great bowl of ice ringed by peaks, there's a place mountaineers know well. It's a common staging camp, a spot where the climbers gather before they push for the summit, and it carries his name. The Sheldon Amphitheater, they call it, up around the 7,000-8,000 foot mark on the Ruth Glacier. He built a little hexagonal mountain house up there, perched on a rock outcrop, so people could sit and take in that cathedral of stone and ice he loved so much. Imagine that as your monument. Not a statue in a park, a whole amphitheater of glaciers, at the foot of the highest mountain on the continent, where his airplanes used to land. Don Sheldon died in 1975. Cancer got him far too young. But the mountain pilots of Alaska are still up there today, flying climbers and skiers and dreamers onto those same glaciers, using the techniques he pioneered with nobody to teach him. Every ski landing on Denali is a page out of a book that Don Sheldon wrote with his own two hands on the stick. So the next time you're wandering these grounds at Oshkosh and you find yourself over here on the bush plane ramp, stop for a minute. Look at these homely, beautiful, capable little airplanes. Big tires, high wings, nothing fancy. And know that machines just like these, in the hands of a quiet man from Talkeetna, did things on the side of a 20,000-foot mountain that the engineers said were impossible. That's the magic of this stuff. It was never really about the airplane. It was always about the pilot. If you want to read the whole story, and you should, there's a wonderful old book called Wager with the Wind by James Greiner that lays out Sheldon's life in full, and the National Park Service keeps the history of Denali's flying pioneers alive as well. My thanks to them for keeping the man's memory sharp. You can find us anytime at radiohanger.com. This is Tail Dragger out here on the bush plane ramp, where the tundra tires never quite let go of the dream. Go find one of these airplanes today and just look at it. You'll understand. See you next time.